Today is Friday, November 12th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Carol Van Damme in Washington. Coming up, COP26 is wrapping up in Scotland. Will the final document include tough language on curbing global warming?
We condemn the orchestrated instrumentalization of human beings whose lives and well-being have been put in danger.
The next climate summit will take place in Egypt, and Egyptian officials are ready.
We understand how important it is that the next COP is an African COP, and our logo is a United Africa for a Resilient Future.
And a U.S. appeals court judge puts off allowing congressional investigators access to former President Trump's documents. We'll have those stories and more next. It's the final day of the COP26 climate summit in Scotland, and there are still wide disagreements over language on efforts to curb global warming. Reporter Henry Ridgewell in Glasgow tells me the draft document being circulated on Friday calls for all nations to strengthen their emissions cutting targets by next year, but is vague in its language.
The latest draft of the climate summit agreement, this cover decision, as it's known, was published Friday morning. And the language has changed somewhat since the first draft was published Wednesday as these last minute negotiations continue. One of the key changes that we've seen over the course of the last few hours is the wording around the phasing out of coal and fossil fuels. Now, the original agreement called upon parties to it to accelerate the phasing out of coal and subsidies for fossil fuels. And now that may sound like weak language, but it's the first time that such a commitment or such a phrase has been included in any cover decision from any of the COP climate summits that have been taking place. So it does represent good progress. But with the second draft, it appears that under pressure from some of the delegations, probably the fossil fuel producers, that language has been changed to accelerating the phase out of unabated coal power and of inefficient subsidies for fossil fuels. So getting somewhat more niche in its wording. Now,
that sounds more like gobbledygook to me. I mean, it sounds very diluted. But I guess that some of the people who are the observers are saying, hey, at least it's still in there. There's some language in there that, like you point out, there never was before.
Right, exactly. And it shows that other countries that are perhaps more committed to that phasing out are fighting hard as well to keep that language in there. That compromise seems to be made on that word unabated coal power. And that's talking about allowing the use of offsetting technologies like carbon capture technologies that effectively would offset the carbon emissions from coal mining and coal consumption. And that would allow it to continue. And the second one, the inefficient subsidies for fossil fuel. So what is an efficient subsidy for fossil fuel? Well, that hasn't been defined in the agreement so far. Perhaps we will get further clarification from that in the coming days.
Is it even possible, Henry, to think that there would be numbers attached to that?
Unlikely, no. So these cover decisions, these final texts are brief by design in that if you get too much detail in them, you'll never get all 200, nearly 200 parties to this agreement to sign it. So the phrasing is broad, it's lacking details, and the best you can hope for, I think, is a general phrase like that. What pressure groups do want, what environmental groups do want, is more dates in this. So when are those fossil fuels going to be phased out by and by how much? Whether they'll get them will remain to be seen.
I thought that this was supposed to end at 6 p.m. your time, Scottish time. So is it possible then that the deadline's going to be moved?
It is, yes. The gavel by the chairman is supposed to go down at 6 p.m. local time this evening, and then the summit is supposed to wrap up. But the way things are going, much of the thought here is that it could continue. It is possible to continue through the night, indeed through the coming weekend, if presidency, the UK presidency of COP26, believes that there is potential to seal an agreement. And that does seem a high possibility at the moment.
That was correspondent Henry Ridgewell speaking with me from Glasgow on the last day of the climate summit. Egypt has been selected to host the UN climate conference next year. Last month, Egypt's president Abdel Fattah el-Sisi officially declared his country's interest in hosting the summit. From Glasgow, global affairs journalist and analyst Ahmed Fathi talked to Egyptian Minister for International Cooperation Rania Del Mashat about what it means for Egypt to host such a mega event.
Well, we're all very pleased to be here at COP26, and we understand how important it is that the next COP is an African COP, and our logo is a United Africa for a Resilient Future, and this is really important. Even though Africa only contributes 4% to total emissions, it is one of the most affected regions. And in the case of Egypt, we have a very good story to tell in terms of the different projects that are linked to mitigation, adaptation. And we want to be able to showcase that and show how our expertise could be also shared with other countries. Tomorrow, the end of the consultations here in Glasgow, and whatever is going to be left on the agenda is going to be pushed with us forward over the next 12 months. We are all very ready and very excited to be the host next time. And we want to make sure that we have an effective 12 months where we land in Sharm el-Sheikh with very practical and on-the-ground solutions.
Egypt's resilience and preparedness for the climate change. And Egypt does not have that many emission levels compared to other industrialized nations. How is the private sector is capitalizing on the abundance of finance we have seen here in the COP26? Literally, it's flushed with cash for those who can come and take it. I'm not speaking about governmental here. I'm speaking about private sector and funding, and whether through the development banks or even through commercial banks. There was an alliance, Citibank, USB, Switzerland, Bank of America, and others who have launching a green fund. And even one of these funds has been put on the exchange in Johannesburg in South Africa. And the same fund is going to be also coming to the NASDAQ very soon. Where is Egypt from all of that compared to other African countries?
So, of course, you know, the word green comes up on so many levels, and ESG is something that different firms are trying to implement. Green finance is something that financiers are trying to guarantee, and green policies is something that governments are trying to activate. So there's a stakeholder engagement focus, a vision that is very shared today. And what is quite important, and this is, you know, we had a panel on innovative financing and trying to create an integrated global framework for this. We want all stakeholders to be engaged. Everyone has a role to play. We are hearing a lot of topics, innovative finance, blended, de-risking. So it's very important to put a plan going forward where each stakeholder and its role is quite well understood.
That was Egyptian Minister for International Cooperation Dalia Al-Mashat speaking with global affairs analyst Ahmed Fathi in Glasgow. A U.S. appeals court late Thursday put off allowing congressional investigators access to former President Donald Trump's White House records that relate to the January 6th attack on the U.S. Capitol. A hearing on the matter was scheduled for November 30th. I asked VOA White House correspondent Patsy Whitaker-Squara about the significance of it being only a temporary ruling.
Well, yes, the ruling is only temporary, and that means that the former President Trump's team will have more time to delay the case, which appears to be part of their strategy, because every day without providing documents to Congress is a win. Remember that we're talking about documents that could shed light on events leading up to the attack on Congress by Trump supporters on January 6th of this year. So the goal for Trump is to delay as long as possible. In fact, up to the midterms election in 2022, if possible, because if Republicans win then the committee investigating the January 6th insurrection attempt is expected to be out of business. So the next legal move for the Trump team is to prepare for oral arguments, which are set on November 30th, which means that a ruling won't likely come until early December. And once the ruling is available, if the Trump team loses, he can ask the full appeals court to review the case rather than just the three judges on the panel, which are all nominated by Democrats. And should the court agree to that request, you'll see more filings and more debates and more oral arguments possibly, in essence, more time off the clock. And if the court does not agree to take the case, former President Trump can take the case to the Supreme Court, which is an even slower process and more time for Trump to delay.
Given all that, what's the strategy of the congressional investigators moving forward?
So they're saying that this ruling does not impact their ability to gather information because they will continue their work no matter what. There are other ways in which they're trying to get information, including by slapping subpoenas on individuals within the Trump circle. The committee has now issued more than 30 subpoenas, including to former chief of staff Mark Meadows, former advisor Stephen Miller, former press secretary Kayleigh McEnany, and many others. It's so far unclear if they will eventually subpoena Trump, although they said that they haven't ruled anything out.
Could this go as far as, you know, possible charges coming out of this investigation? Could they go all the way up to former President Trump himself?
Well, yes. I mean, that's the goal, right? I mean, and the panel has already interviewed more than 150 witnesses, and lawmakers have said that they don't only just want to probe the attack itself, but also its origins, namely the lies that former President Trump has spread about massive voter fraud, even though all 50 states had certified President Joe Biden's wins, and courts across the country have rejected this claim. So this is a big investigation. And here's one person who may be key to all of this, Mike Pence and his aides, particularly if he or they are willing to testify against their former boss. We learned just today that in an interview with ABC News, Trump said that he considered common sense for his supporters to chant "Hang Mike Pence" on January 6th. And that he never feared for the vice president's safety. So comments like this could possibly motivate individuals within Pence's inner circle who are already angry about the way the vice president was treated by Trump. And they may decide that the time has come to get the full story out and work together with the committee. We'll just have to see.
That was VOA's White House correspondent and White House bureau chief, Patsy Whitaker-Squara, speaking with me on Friday. Russia traded barbs with Western members of the UN Security Council on Thursday over a crisis on the border between Belarus and Poland, with Russia's deputy UN envoy suggesting his European colleagues have masochist inclinations. Reuters correspondent Jason Albano reports.
Russia traded barbs with Western members of the UN Security Council on Thursday over the migrant crisis on the Belarus-Poland border. The European Union has accused Belarus of encouraging thousands of migrants to cross into Poland and other neighboring countries as retaliation for sanctions. Many have done so with wire cutters they say were given to them by Belarusian border guards. The Security Council's Western bloc on Thursday condemned Belarus's actions, calling President Alexander Lukashenko a threat to regional stability.
We condemn the orchestrated instrumentalization of human beings whose lives and well-being have been put in danger for political purposes by Belarus, with the objective of destabilizing neighboring countries.
Russia doubled down on its support for ally Belarus, though it has denied its own involvement in the crisis. Its deputy ambassador to the UN, Dmitry Polyansky, called the accusations masochistic.
Frankly, I started to suspect that maybe our Estonian, French and other colleagues, they have some kind of masochist inclinations, because to raise this topic, which are total shame for the EU in front of us, would be very brave.
Poland's defense ministry on Thursday released footage of what appeared to be border guards sending migrants away. While Belarus warned the crisis could escalate into a military confrontation. Ukraine, which has said it would deploy thousands more troops on its own border, also released footage of drills meant to hold migrants back. Most of the migrants have remained trapped between Belarus and Poland's borders, enduring freezing weather in makeshift camps. Poland has reported at least 7 migrant deaths in the months-long crisis.
That was Reuters correspondent Jason Albano reporting. Sponsors have been asked to defend support for the Beijing Winter Olympics. AP correspondent Mike Gracia has that story.
Human Rights Watch has asked leading sponsors of the Beijing Winter Olympics to explain why they remain largely silent about alleged human rights abuses in China. In an online briefing, the rights group said it reached out to all but one of the IOC's so-called top sponsors in lengthy letters almost 6 months ago. The only reply came from Allianz last month, saying we stand behind the Olympic movement. Earlier this week, the International Trade Union Confederation issued a scathing report alleging genocide and crimes against humanity in the Xinjiang region of northwest China. The Beijing Games open February 4th. I'm Mike Gracia.
A court in the military ruled Myanmar on Friday jailed American journalist Danny Fenster for 11 years, according to his lawyer and employer. The 37-year-old managing editor of the online magazine Frontier Magazine was found guilty of incitement and violations of the Immigration and Unlawful Associations Law. Frontier Magazine describes the sentences as the harshest possible under the law. The U.S. government and others have been trying to secure Fenster's release. Europe is seeing the largest rate of increase in COVID-19 cases in the world. Some European officials are considering reimposing unpopular lockdowns leading up to the heavy travel season around Christmas and stirring debate over whether vaccines alone are enough to control COVID-19. In Afghanistan, an explosion rocked a mosque in Nangarhar province in the eastern part of the country. At least 12 people were wounded, including the imam of the mosque, according to local residents. One resident said the blast occurred around 1:30 Friday afternoon when explosives, apparently located in the interior of the mosque, detonated. An Israeli court on Thursday upheld a ruling to return to Italy a 6-year-old boy, the sole survivor of an Italian cable car disaster, who was kidnapped and taken to Israel by his grandfather. Reuters correspondent Gloria So reports.
An Israeli court has upheld a ruling to return 6-year-old Eitan Baran to Italy, Israel's justice ministry said Thursday, after he was kidnapped earlier this year. Baran was the sole survivor of a cable car disaster in northern Italy in May, which killed his parents, younger brother, and 11 other people. With his paternal aunt in Italy when his maternal grandfather visited in September and took him to Israel without consent. Baran's aunt petitioned a Tel Aviv family court to return him to Italy, kicking off a cross-border custody battle. The court found that his grandfather's actions amounted to kidnapping under the Hague Convention on the Return of Abducted Children. The grandfather later appealed the ruling to a Tel Aviv district court, which ultimately upheld the family court's decision. The court has held off implementing the order for a week in order to enable his grandfather to appeal to Israel's Supreme Court, adding that he should still be allowed to meet with his grandson even in Italy. Lawyers for the grandfather say they will consider appealing to the Supreme Court after studying the ruling.
That was Reuters correspondent Gloria So. This is VOA News.
This is Science in a Minute.
Scientists from the University of Arizona in Tucson say in a press release that they found evidence a near-Earth asteroid might be a fragment of the moon. The object is described as a quasi-satellite, which means it orbits the sun but remains within a rather close distance to Earth. The asteroid, called Kamu'u-Alava, was discovered in 2016 by scientists working with the Pan-STARRS Astronomical Survey. The U of A team says it's about 46 to 58 meters in diameter and can get as close as 14.5 million kilometers from Earth. Using the large binocular telescope in southern Arizona, the scientists found the asteroid's spectrum of electromagnetic radiation is the same as lunar rocks gathered by NASA's Apollo moon missions. The researchers say they aren't sure how the object broke away from the moon. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
New research finds that the COVID-19 pandemic has hurt the financial viability of media outlets in southern Africa, with print media being the worst hit. Columbus Mavunga reports from Zimbabwe's capital, where the impact has been felt particularly hard.
Launching the report, researcher Reginald Rumini, a journalism professor at Rhodes University in South Africa, said the media in the region had been drastically affected by the COVID-19 pandemic.
This crisis, particularly the lockdowns and the restrictions on movement, it was force audiences online or to consume broadcast news. Newspapers and magazines were particularly hard hit. And of course, with the decline in circulation came a huge drop in revenue and retrenchment of staff, but a big restructuring of the newspaper industry across the region. A lot of papers were forced to go online, stop printing completely. Retrenchments were dramatic.
In Zimbabwe, Alpha Media, which publishes Newsday, the Zimbabwe Independent and the Standard, stopped printing paper copies of its newspapers for months, moving all publications online. All of its staff received a 50% cut, while those not directly involved in e-paper production were put on leave. In South Africa, Associated Media Publishing stopped publishing its magazines, which included Cosmopolitan, House and Leisure, and Women on Wheels, while Caxstone and CPT Publishers and Printers announced the closure of their magazine division. South Africa's Weekly Mail and Garden kept publishing, but said some advertisers had cancelled their campaigns. Rumini said without a dramatic turnaround or external assistance, such as donor funds, most media houses in Southern Africa would not get out of the hole that the coronavirus put them in. Johanna Gadzikwa is a media professor in South Africa. At the launch, she said the pandemic had caused a redefinition of the media industry in Southern Africa that could have a harmful effect on the region's societies.
The death or decline in circulation figures is quite worrisome. What do we think should be the way forward? Because news is something that we cannot not have in our societies. A lot is happening in Zimbabwe, in Southern Africa, that if issues do not see the light of print like this, we are heading towards another major catastrophe. The pandemic has thrown everything upside down, but also when things remain in that, it becomes a huge problem.
The issue has extra resonance in Zimbabwe, where advocates for the media say authorities have assaulted journalists in the line of duty. Nigel Nyamutumbu is the head of Media Alliance of Zimbabwe.
In terms of Zimbabwe, you find that they, on one hand, we have a problem of money, or we have a problem of resources, and we have also the problem of politics, political will, where you can speak of even the statutory instruments that were used to enforce the lockdown, where you also use the weaponization of the COVID-19 to actually clamp down in a calculated manner some civil liberties, including that of free expression and including that of media freedom, which by extension obviously affect media sustainability.
Nyamutumbu says one cannot have a thriving media in an unconducive operating environment. And right now, even with COVID-19 slowly coming under control, Southern Africa is not a conducive environment for print journalism. Columbus Mavunga for VOA News, Harare, Zimbabwe.
The Danish creator of The Pillar of Shame has asked Hong Kong authorities for assurances that he won't be prosecuted under the city's national security law as he tries to take the statue back to Denmark. Reuters reporter Drew Tykar has more.
The creator of a statue that commemorates protesters killed during the Tiananmen Square crackdown says he wants immunity from Hong Kong's national security law so that he can take the sculpture back to Denmark. Artist Jens Galschut made the request in an open letter on Friday, saying that his presence in the city was necessary for the operation to relocate the Pillar of Shame to go well. Galschut said he wanted reassurances that he would not be prosecuted under a sweeping national security law that was imposed by Beijing in 2020. The legislation is aimed at punishing acts of subversion, secession, terrorism, and collusion with foreign forces. The 8-meter-tall, 2-ton copper sculpture depicts dozens of torn and twisted bodies and is set to mark China's crackdown in 1989 on pro-democracy protesters in Tiananmen Square. It's been on display at the University of Hong Kong for more than two decades and was loaned by the Danish sculptor to a local civil society group, the Hong Kong Alliance in Support of Patriotic Democratic Movements in China, in perpetuity. However, in October, the school asked the group to remove the statue from its premises and set a deadline for it, which expired a month ago. That was all after the alliance had already disbanded weeks before with some of its members being accused of national security offenses. The university, Hong Kong's Security Bureau, and the Immigration Department did not immediately respond to requests for comment.
That was Reuters reporter Dhruv Thaikar. This has been International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of the entire production team, thank you so much for listening. For pictures, stories, videos, and more, follow VOA News on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. I'm Carol Van Dam in Washington.